equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon, I'm Carl Ettenayer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. We've got a great show coming up for you today on a different sort of subject than I usually handle, but I think it's fundamental to everything else we talk about, which is really how to create a stronger Vermont at a time of great changes. Kate Pickett is the author of, or the co-author of, The Spirit Level, and she and her co-author Richard Wilkinson ask, which is more important for a stronger society, high overall levels of wealth or equal distribution of that wealth? They argue that more equal countries and that more equal U.S. states have greater longevity, fewer homicides, more trust, and a lot of other better outcomes, less obesity, but that average wealth doesn't really matter all that much. So we'll be talking with her the full hour. In the second part of the show, we'll be joined by Ed Paquin. He's a former Vermont state representative. He's currently executive director of Disability Rights Vermont, and he'll put Pickett's findings in a Vermont perspective. First, a couple pieces of old business. 2 weeks ago, we talked in passing about rules for feeding food waste to pigs in Vermont. Last week, I checked in with Agency of Agriculture spokesperson Kelly Loftus, and she told me the agency does not permit farmers to feed unboiled garbage to pigs that are going to be sold to someone else other than the farmer. So is human food garbage, I wondered. What about produce, a head of lettuce that's been taken off the grocery store shelf a few minutes ago? It was good to be fed to humans. Now it's taken off the shelf. Does it have to be boiled before it's fed to pigs? She wasn't sure. Now she's connected me with her colleague, Jim Cameron, and he explained to me that unprocessed human food is considered garbage by the state. It must be boiled if you're going to feed the pig to human. That produce, for example. On the other hand, there's processed food, and that's okay to feed directly without further processing to the pigs. Donuts, bread, even processed dairy products like pasteurized milk. So now you know what the Agency of Agriculture approves for feeding to pigs. It took a little while to get that cleared up, but I want to make sure that on this show, you get accurate information. And last week, second piece of old business, we got a call from Dean in Waitsfield asking a question he'd asked on many shows.
Spent fuel rods that are on, you know, the river there, what would happen if a natural disaster took place? You know, what would be the effects of the nuclear waste going into the river or going into the groundwater?
Our scheduled guest, Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear in Maryland, was still in flight on his way to speak here in Vermont at airtime, so we couldn't get his expertise on the subject of the effect of a flood of the Connecticut River on the dry cask storage there. Fortunately, I talked to Kevin Camps on my other radio show last Thursday, and this is how he answered Dean's question.
The problem with high-level radioactive waste, one of many problems, is that there's still enough fissile material, both uranium-235 and especially plutonium-239, that in the presence of water, submerged in water, those fuel rods could actually spark a chain reaction. They would get very hot, and there is the possibility, since it's not designed to contain a chain reaction, the heat buildup could very well damage the fuel rods or even cause them to catch on fire or to melt down.
So, doesn't that make you feel more secure? Anyway, I'm not going to track down an answer to every question we can't resolve on the air, but when I have the opportunity, I'm happy to oblige. Anyway, on to new business. I've been spending a lot of time in the last couple weeks reading and thinking about this new book, The Spirit Level. It's by a couple of British epidemiologists, but it's only really partially about their normal subjects of health and disease. It's more about quality of life in general. They argue that greater equality means a better quality of life for everyone, even the rich. As I said, the book is called The Spirit Level. It's a British term for a carpenter's level. The subtitle really says it all. Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger. And the book confirms some ideas I've had for a long time, like, you know, Wall Street bankers and brokers getting rich really doesn't make the world a whole lot better place, whereas helping out widows and orphans does. You know, it's nice to get some data confirming what you think you already know, but it's important to keep challenging your own assumptions, too. And the book has done that for me, too. Take school spending and educational outputs. We have, here in Vermont, one of the best education systems in the country. Our students do very well on national tests, and they tend to stay in school. As governor, Jim Douglas has consistently worked to cut funding for schools. And I've been afraid that if he succeeded, he'd save a little money now, and then we'd find student achievement sliding down towards what it is in Mississippi or some other state that doesn't have very good outcomes over years or decades. But after reading this book, The Spirit Level, I wonder, can we decrease spending on schools without decreasing the quality of education, as long as we do other work to increase equality? It sounds like a paradox, but we'll find out more when we talk with the author. And as I said, later in the show, we'll be joined by Ed Paquin. He's the executive director of Vermont Disability Rights and a former state representative, and he'll put things in a Vermont perspective. We do have a caller on the line, who's probably responding to one of the earlier things. So before we jump into the spirit level, why don't we go to Northfield and bring up Scott? Hello, Scott.
Hi, how you doing, Carl?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. The question I have is, I haven't heard any people from New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and other states that may be affected by Vermont Yankee Nuclear and Entergy in case of a toxic spill or what have you. And I'm just curious, they must have a voice. They must be concerned.
Yep, that's a good question, and many of them are active in the organization called CAN. I always forget exactly what that stands for. It's not exactly what you'd think. Citizens, I don't remember right offhand. If you look up the chairperson of it or the director of it, Deb Katz, K-A-T-Z, and the organization CAN, I think it's even based in northwestern Massachusetts, kind of near Vernon, but still in Massachusetts. They are talking about Vermont Yankee.
I'm just curious. I'd sure like to hear the voices a little louder,
Okay.
Yay or nay.
Thanks for the call, Scott.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. So as I said, we're going to be talking with Kate Pickett. She is a professor of epidemiology at the University of York. She's on the phone with us right now from the UK, and she's a co-author of The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Society Stronger. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Kate, you and your co-author, Richard Wilkinson, you're both epidemiologists, so you study public health. Could you explain how you came to write a book on equality?
That's right. As epidemiologists, we study the causes of health or disease or well-being in populations rather than in individuals, trying to understand what explains differences in population health. Why is one population healthier than another? And both Richard and I are social epidemiologists, and so we study the social determinants of health, things to do with social structures in society. And we've been looking at influences of income inequality, the gap between rich and poor, on health for quite a long time, but it's only since we've been working together that we started to realize that that gap actually affected a lot more things besides health, a big range of health and social problems.
And this is quite a range of health and social problems. We'll get to the range in a minute. Why don't you begin by telling us how you set up your study? It's a fascinating both international comparison and a couple of researchers in the UK looking at 50 United States.
That's right. We started out by looking at rich countries. We're only analyzing the rich, market, developed countries, because those are the ones where economic growth is no longer important for public health. They're the countries where average levels of health are no longer associated with levels of life expectancy, for instance, or levels of happiness. So we took the 50 richest countries in the world. We dropped those that had very small populations because we didn't want to include tax havens. And we kept those that had good internationally comparable data on the differences between the incomes of the rich and the poor. And that gave us, for most of our analyses, 21 countries. Occasionally we have data for a couple more countries. It's sort of 21 to 23 rich developed countries.
Okay, let me stop you for a minute there. I want to underline what you just said. You are not going out in your studies and inventing new types of data to gather. You're taking established types of data that people have already consistently gathered internationally.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And we're not talking about perfect utopian levels of equality. We're comparing, you know, where countries are at. And all of the countries we're looking at are wealthy countries, they're capitalist countries, they're market democracies. So, you know, we're talking about countries where they are today. But because we were very aware that our findings were politically very sensitive, we wanted to test it all again in a sort of separate test bed. And so we compared everything a second time, looking at the 50 states of the USA. So everything that we do looking at rich countries, we also do looking at the 50 states.
And why did you pick the USA rather than shires or counties or something in the UK or provinces in France?
Partly because you've got a nice number of them.
Uh-huh.
50 is a large number, and when you're doing statistical analysis, you know, you want to be able to compare a large number of societies. But also because to some extent, the 50 states do act like separate societies. And we're interested in societal levels of inequality where people think they fit into the national scale of income differences. And the states act much more like nation states than counties of the UK do or regions of France do, for instance.
So the federalist model really is noticeable in that
yes,
respect.
Yes.
And what is equality or inequality?
Well, what we're measuring is income inequality. Specifically, when we're comparing different countries, we're asking how much richer are the top fifth of the population compared to the bottom fifth. So our measure of income inequality is simply the ratio of the incomes of the top 20% to the bottom 20%. We use a similar measure for US states. There's lots of different measures that economists have developed to look at income inequality, and we wanted one that was easy for people to understand.
And in between countries, what sort of levels of inequality did you find, income inequality between the top 20% and the bottom 20%?
Well, looking at the more equal end, we have countries like Japan and the Scandinavian countries, and there the top 20% have incomes that are about 3.5 to 4 times as large as the bottom 20%. And in the more unequal countries, and that's Australia, New Zealand, Portugal, the USA, and when we have data for it, Singapore, the ratio between the top 20% and the bottom 20% is more like 7 to 9 times as much. So we're about twice as unequal as the more equal societies in our data set.
Okay, so twice as unequal, but not 10 times as unequal.
Not 10 times, no. Yeah.
So it's a maybe a narrow range, but broad enough to show significant differences in all sorts of outcomes. What do you want to begin talking about? It's so rich, all the different outcomes that you put into your indicators of quality of life.
Yeah, it's hard to know where to start, isn't it? We find that inequality affects such a wide range of things. It's as if it causes a sort of a general social dysfunction for societies, so that it affects social aspects of the society, like levels of trust and violence and imprisonment, but also levels of health, mental health, physical health. I think you mentioned obesity in your introduction to the program, but also levels of education and social mobility and the way children are doing. So it's very, very widespread.
So why don't we start with something, you know, close to your more traditional field of expertise, public health, and tell us about the connection between longevity and equality and what you think might underlie that.
Well, this is really where it all started, and it's quite clear that there is a robust relationship between levels of income inequality in this society and life expectancy. There's been close to 200 studies now academic studies of income inequality and health. And it's very clear that when it's measured at the level of whole nations or states, that inequality has a very strong impact on life expectancy. And I think the reasons for that are very well understood now. And this is where us being epidemiologists, I think, and starting out from that point of view is a strength. Because in public health, I think we've spent the last probably three decades really coming to a much greater understanding of how powerful the psychosocial influences are on health. Things like low social status, not having friends or a strong social network, stress in early childhood. And we understand the biological mechanisms for those very well. You know, we understand how chronic stress affects our physiology and our health. And so all we're saying really is that what we've understood for a long time about those social influences on health, they all get worse in a more unequal society.
So you go so far as to say in your book, The Spirit Level, that the income inequality is maybe a stand-in, a surrogate for some measure of overall hierarchy in society.
That's right. We think of income inequality, I mean, it's a useful measure. We can get data on it for different countries, for different states. But what we think it is, it's sort of the skeleton upon which all of the social differences between us hang. So it's a very good marker of how hierarchical a society is, how big the social distances between us are. If you think of a society like a ladder, with some people at the bottom and some at the top, income inequality not only tells us a bit about how steep that ladder is, but how far apart those rungs are, how hard it is to climb.
Hmm. And for individuals, how important is, say, the wealth of that individual for longevity versus the equality of the society? So I realize that you looked at privileged societies, the U.S. as a whole, the 50 states of the United States, and then you chose your other 21 to 23 countries for your international comparison from the 50 wealthiest countries in the world. But
sure.
Within these groups, say a rich person in a very unequal society, is that person better off health-wise than a poor person in a much more equal society?
That's not quite the right comparison.
Okay.
Within every society, there's a social gradient in health and in all of the other problems that we look at. So they're much more common among the poorest members of society or in the most deprived areas or neighborhoods. So within every society, income matters a lot. It's when you compare across societies that you realize that average levels of income don't matter, or how much you earn or your level of education doesn't matter across societies. So if I were to take you or me and we were to look at our level of income, our education, we would probably be doing quite well within our own societies, I would guess, because we'd rank quite high. But if you transported us with our same level of income and education to a more equal society, we would be doing better whatever our level of income.
Hmm.
So we wouldn't be richer or better off in a more equal society, but we would benefit in all kinds of health and social outcomes.
So one of our senators in the state of Vermont, Bernie Sanders, has brought people from Finland here to talk about the benefits of the very equal society they
mm-hmm.
have in Finland. You're saying that any one of us, I think you're saying across the spectrum, not just relatively well-off people in Vermont or in York in the UK, but anybody would be better off if transported to Finland. Is that correct?
Exactly. If being living in a more equal society, that's right.
Right.
Whether
yeah,
you're comparing states or countries, yeah.
Right. We don't want to have to learn Finnish because it's a very difficult language.
No, I agree.
Okay.
But they do come at the. It's interesting that the Finns come absolute top on educational achievement. Maybe it's because their language is so difficult.
Mm.
They have to work really hard.
Mm. Yeah, and they have to learn Swedish and English on top of their own language.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about education. Let's make that switch as a nice bridge from longevity and other physical outcomes to educational performance. What did you study when it came to educational performance?
We compared two things. Internationally and across the states, we looked at scores that kids have on literacy and maths. So there are international institutions that are set up to provide these comparable data to say, you know, are kids in Finland actually doing better than kids elsewhere? But we also looked at levels of high school dropout in different U.S. states. And in both cases, with educational achievement and with dropping out of high school, we find that more equal societies do so, so much better. And I think that's a very, very important finding.
And why would that be?
I think in part it relates to how parents and early childhood play into this, which we could perhaps talk about a bit later. The value that is placed on different segments of society doing well, the value that people lower down society put on education. But we look at social mobility as well, and I think this plays into it as very, very strongly. And I think it's really important to say what we mean by that, because I think social mobility is an area that America's always prided itself on. The American dream is that anybody can achieve if they work hard. But when we looked at measures of social mobility for different countries, we found that actually the USA scored worst of all of the countries we looked at.
Mm.
So in a way, more unequal societies are wasting more of their human potential.
Because if we were more of a meritocracy in this country, then we would have smart people who are born to parents who haven't achieved a lot, and they could move up into leading positions in society. But it's only a myth that happens here.
Exactly. And we can always come across stories of somebody who's done very well. I mean, your president at the moment is a shining example.
Raised by a single mother.
Yeah. But he's the exception, really, that proves the rule. And societies where more people have more opportunities are those that have fewer differences between rich and poor.
Hmm. Well, we'll get back to education in the second half of this show. We're talking with Kate Pickett, if you've just tuned in. She is a co-author of The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger. It's published last year in the UK, and I believe it's just this year in the United States. Is that correct, Kate?
I think it came out at the end of December in the United States, yes.
Oh, okay, and it's got a foreword by Robert Reich in the U.S. edition, so that's a blue ribbon recommendation there. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking with Ed Paquin. He is a former state representative and currently the executive director of Disability Rights Vermont. He'll help us put this in a Vermont perspective. Before we get to him, though, I want to take up one more subject that you and your co-author studied, Kate Pickett, and that is violence, imprisonment, punishment. Just put it all together in crime. Tell us how and why that relates to equality.
Yes, it's a very strong finding. There have been about 50 studies of levels of violent crime in relation to inequality, and consistent finding that more unequal societies have higher levels of violence. In fact, they're so large. If we compare Canadian provinces and U.S. states, the differences are about tenfold. There are about 10 times as many murders per head of population in the more unequal states as there are in the more equal Canadian provinces. So that's a huge difference. And it's very, very similar for levels of imprisonment. But what's really interesting is that imprisonment isn't just predicted by levels of crime. It seems to be mostly driven by harsher criminal justice systems, a greater tendency to send people to prison for various crimes and to send them away for longer. So it's as if the whole society becomes harsher, more strict, more punitive, and we see that reflected in levels of imprisonment as well as levels of violence and levels of child conflict as well.
Hmm. Well, Vermont is, according to the figures you present, one of the more equal states in the United States. And we kind of confound advocates of stricter gun laws in this country because we have very lax gun laws compared to other states, and yet very few homicides using guns. And it sounds to me like you're saying we can point to our high level of equality as being at least partially responsible to that.
Yes, I think you really can, and it's true. You are among the most equal states. I was actually asked on one radio program what state would I like to live in, and I picked Vermont because of its incredibly good performance on all of the things we're looking at, and its very low levels of inequality.
Well, flattery will get you everywhere, Kate Pickett. I wonder about this, though. When we talk about these social indicators of tendency towards criminality, towards violence, towards having people in prison, how much are we moving away from the model of individual responsibility for behavior? And aren't people, rather than their societies, responsible for whether they break the law or not?
Of course, within any society, any individual is responsible for their own actions. But if we look at different societies, they have incredibly different levels of violence. And that makes you ask why. Clearly, there isn't something odd going on that's genetic. You know, we can compare different states, and it's not something genetic that's going on causing different levels of violence among different states. We can look over time and see trends changing, and clearly there's something in the environment that's happening. It's not about removing individual responsibility. One's responsibility for a crime would always be there. But clearly some societies manage to create social environments where crime happens less. Hmm. And that must be something we would all want to strive for. We all would like to live in a more peaceful, less violent society.
Hmm. So I don't know if you're familiar with the musical West Side Story over in the UK, but
yes.
And some of the young hoodlums sing about how their crime is not really their fault; it's a social disease. And you're saying, well, there's some truth to that.
There is some truth to that. Yes.
Mm. Very, very good. Well, we'll continue this conversation with Kate Pickett. She is the co-author of The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Society Stronger. We'll get back to Vermont, compare Vermont with New Hampshire in this context, and we'll bring in Ed Paquin, who, as a former state representative and now the executive director of Vermont Disability Rights, has a lot of expertise in applying these issues to Vermont.
Dear kindly Sergeant Krupke, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us, there is good.
There is good.
There is good. There is good. There is untapped.
That's the original Broadway cast of West Side Story with the song G Officer Krupke. I'm Carl Ettenayer. Welcome back to Equal Time. We're talking today about the new book, The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger. We're talking with the co-author Kate Pickett. We're now going to bring on Ed Paquin. He is a former five-term state representative. He is now the director of Disability Rights Vermont, which was formerly known as Vermont Protection and Advocacy. And he's also part of something we'll hear a little bit about called the One Vermont Initiative. Ed, welcome to Equal Time.
Thank you. It's very good to be with you.
Could you begin? I located you as a guest for today's show to provide us with some perspective through some inquiries about the One Vermont Initiative. Could you begin by explaining that to us?
Sure. Although it's very hard for me to open up without giving a little plug for my own organization, but I'll do so in the context of One Vermont.
Beautiful.
Our organization is a federally funded, but it's a private nonprofit, and we do advocacy work for people with disabilities, both legal and lay advocacy, investigating abuse, neglect, and civil rights violations against people with disabilities. I became interested in the One Vermont issue. I do have a history in the state legislature. I served six terms back in the 90s, beginning at a time in 91 when we were in a budget situation that's very similar to this one. And I have to say, I've watched the state change over the course of my lifetime, and maybe most particularly in the last decade or so, where it just seems as though policy decisions at a number of different levels have tended to bring segments of Vermont apart. We've always, well, I can't say we've always, but we've had a very robust social service system. We've had an economy that certainly worked well for people who want to get ahead, but it also worked well for people who were perhaps on the lower end of the scale and who, for whatever reasons, needed some social structures or some public structures to assist them at different times in their lives. We've had a strong health care in this state more than some others. And so I can, there's a ring of truth to it when Dr. Pickett talks about the equality in the state of Vermont. But what's concerning, and there is actual research out of the University of New Hampshire that shows that we're trending away from that kind of equality that Dr. Pickett is talking about. And One Vermont, by its title, gives you a little hint as to what it's about. We are hoping to continue to live in one state where our public policy and our private economy are all robust and work towards a society in which we can all take part, and we don't have to sort of run for the bushes or run behind our gates as they do in some places where the income gap and other kinds of social gaps are greater.
Well, I'll put a link on. Talk over you there. I'll put a link, Ed Paquin, on our website, equaltimeradio.com, to both your organization, onevermont.org, and also Vermont Disability Rights, so that people have an opportunity to check that out some more. And I'll also give you full credit for your six terms in the Vermont legislature.
There we go. Well, thank you for that. What One Vermont has brought together a number of different organizations from a lot of different sectors, some involved with human services, some involved with environmental, and some with transportation issues, and a lot of individuals. And the idea here is that we've got to look at particularly the economic situation we are in right now in this recession, and ask ourselves, what are there causes that are directly related to the current recession, and are there causes related to something bigger, to income disparity, or to factors like, I would posit, health care, which has been inflating for quite a long time? And to get realistic, to get a balanced approach going where we look at both sides of an equation, not just cutting programs where really what we need is to work towards the kind of equality that Dr. Pickett talks to, and that would really require some participation in the solutions by those of us in the society who fare a little better economically.
So you're not shy about talking about raising new revenues, taxes, or fees?
Well, I personally am not. I mm-hmm. think that we've seen that be very useful, contribute to a good solutions in the past. Certainly when I was first in the legislature, we had a very, very tough budget situation. We did a lot of pretty deep cuts, employee layoffs at the state level that were similar to what we've seen in the last couple of years. But we also raised substantial enough revenue so that we didn't really dismantle the social service structure, transportation structure, and the other public structures that really work towards making Vermont a desirable place to live.
And we saw just last week in Oregon that you can sell this to voters, raising the highest marginal tax rates, income tax rates, on the wealthiest Oregonians passed in a referendum there in Oregon, raising it from 9 to 11%, if I recall correctly. So there is political support for it, at least out there.
Yes, and I must say that in the UK, we've recently had a rise in our top tax rate up to 50%, and that's passed without a murmur.
Very interesting. Thanks for that perspective, Kate Pickett. Before we jump, I want to go to education with the both of you and talk about that and its relationship to equality a little bit more and what that tells us for choices we should be making here in Vermont. Before I jump into that, Ed Paquin, you listened to the first part of this show. Any reflections you want to make further on what Kate Pickett had to say?
I am going to make one observation, and I want to thank Dr. Pickett for her work. And I think maybe I'll say it in a slightly humorous way, that I would observe that at last we have good reason to believe that feudalism is a bad thing. I think that what Dr. Pickett shows is that when we attend to all of society's needs, instead of thinking that the approach is to only focus on one part of society and assume that a high volume of economic activity necessarily means that the entire society benefits. And I think Dr. Pickett, your work to some extent puts the lie to the efficacy of the trickle-down theory, and I think supports the idea that we all need to invest in a healthy society, and that means a little more broad involvement in solutions to the kinds of problem we've got now than just cutting programs that make life practical and tolerable for folks who are, as we say here, behind the eight ball.
Thank you. Yes, I think you've got that exactly right. Yes.
You're comfortable with your work being used to denounce feudalism?
Indeed,
okay.
I am, yes.
Very good. Well, let's talk about education. And Kate Pickett, just to bring you up to speed on 10, 15 years of educational history in Vermont very quickly, we passed a law called Act 60, gosh, it must have been 10, 11 years ago, that had the effect of making education within Vermont much more equal, using state funds to even out the differences in what wealthier and less wealthy towns were able to raise through their property tax. One result of that, and it was an intended result, was that spending on schools rapidly increased, especially in the towns that had been less wealthy before and were trying to catch up with state norms. Now, like I think every other state in the union and most countries, we're facing budget crises, and there's talk about cutting spending on schools in various ways. I won't go into the details of them. And yet we remain, by the figures that you use in your book, one of the most equal states in the country, and you have shown that there's a very high correlation between equality and good educational outcomes. So I'm wondering, as long as we maintain that equality, do we have leeway to cut our educational spending overall within the state and still maintain those high outcomes? Or are there other things that we need to be thinking about while doing that?
I think there probably are other things. I mean, I think the fact that you, as a more equal state, have chosen as a state to put more money and effort into your public school education system reflects your greater equality. You know, it's symbolic of a more equal society that wants to do the right thing for everybody. If you have to make cuts, then I would suggest that any cuts that have to be made should come higher up the educational hierarchy and not be around early childhood programs or elementary education, because it's really there that more equal societies manage to sort of shore up the damages that are caused by inequality. Early childhood is such an important, sensitive period for the way people develop throughout their whole lives in terms of their health, their well-being, their achievements. And so any spending at that point will be much, much more effective than any other time. But if you don't get a more equal society, you'll have to keep spending on those programs forever and ever.
You cited in your book an astonishing study, I thought, a nationwide study in the UK, and I'm reading from your book, found that by the age of 3 years, children from disadvantaged backgrounds were already educationally up to a year behind children from more privileged homes.
Yes,
by 3 years.
That was a shock. Those data come from our Millennium Cohort study. It's a huge study. It's got about 19,000 families in it, all of whom had children born around the time of the millennium. And it was following them up over time. And they found that by the age of three, you're right, that there was a gap of 12 months difference in achievement between the children of the most educated parents and those of the least. So the gap had opened up before children had ever got close to school.
Hmm. One of the things that we've seen in Vermont in recent years is more state, more tax dollars going to pay for pre-kindergarten. If I'm understanding, and Ed Paquin, jump in and correct me if I'm getting something wrong here, to pay for preschool, pre-kindergarten, so that kids at a younger age can be exposed to the learning environment of the school. And that sounds to me like the sort of thing that you'd support keeping up and maybe even going back earlier than that.
Oh, absolutely. I think early childhood programs are really important. But, I mean, it begs the question of why we need them. You know, why is early childhood such a sensitive period? It's not an evolutionary accident. Children are sensitive to the kind of world they're being brought up in. Their parents are passing on to them their experience of the kind of society they live in. And we as humans have the potential to be very kind, very cooperative, very reciprocal, or to be quite competitive, out for ourselves, watching our backs all the time. And the kind of society we live in prepares us for the kind of society we will be adults in. Our parents pass it on. And what we're doing with early childhood programs is sort of trying to fix those problems. And when we talk about actually reducing inequalities in society, we're talking about preventing the sort of the root causes of those difficulties in the first place.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Kate Pickett. She's a co-author of The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger. We also have on the line Ed Paquin. He's the executive director of Disability Rights Vermont. I'm Carl Etnayer. This is Equal Time. Ed Paquin, your reflection on Kate Pickett's comments on the importance of early childhood education and just good, solid early childhoods for Vermont kids.
Well, I think I like when you add just good, solid early childhoods. I really do think there's a lot to be said for that. And I think Dr. Pickett's point, Kate's point, is well taken, that the more equal this society is, the more likely that is going to be in evidence, because if you're going to get a more equal society, in order to do that, you really have to have homes that are supportive of education, homes that are that feel that they have a future and that they can look ahead to a generation. I think I've heard it said that we're living in a generation that's unusual in that we're not looking for the average income earner. We're not looking at a family that has high aspirations that their overall standard of living are going to be greater than what their parents was. And that wasn't true in the generation that I grew up. I won't tell you exactly how old I am, but old enough to have seen a different time and to have seen a lot of progress where intervention at an early age and the amount of support for our schools and for especially higher education in the generation I'm in made a huge difference, and we've backed off on a lot of those things. In the work that we do with Disability Rights Vermont, I would observe that we've seen, since Vermont has put quite a bit of effort into identifying kids with disabilities very early, we've helped to bring into the school door people who are better prepared by the time they get into kindergarten and first grade. And so the early essential education programs and some of the other programs that are connected with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act have brought a focus on identifying kids early, giving them support, and it's clear that that pays off. And I think that there are a lot of jurisdictions in Vermont that offer for the general population more preschool opportunities, and I think that's clearly a good thing, and can work to, if nothing else, to raise aspirations and to raise your ability to be prepared for school, and that's got to pay off in some degree of social mobility. And I think you've got a circle that goes on there.
We're going to bring one of our listeners into the conversation, calling from I-89, is Mr. Siegel. Hello, Mr. Siegel.
Yes, you made a couple comments that are just not factual. One, Act 60 was forced upon the state because of a lawsuit in the Brigham decision. It wasn't because the voters in the state wanted it. The voters in the state didn't want it. And Act 60 was not anything anybody wanted. In fact, what's going on now is that the average is being dumbed down because of some socioeconomic tryings of Act 60, where money from people who have money is being given to people who don't have money. And that's nice if we want to talk about big statements, but in fact what it's done, it's destroying schools throughout the state, because in these schools which had no money, they now have no incentive to save money, and they spend money like drunken soldiers. So the schools within the state are being destroyed, about your comment, first of all. Second of all, this whole economic, social discussion that you're having, I guess the question becomes, should the average be dumbed down because you take money from people who work hard and give it to kids who, unfortunately, their parents have made a decision not to be totally engaged in society, and what we're seeing is throughout the state, schools being destroyed. So I'd be interested in the comments of your speaker now that she knows the facts of Act 60.
Well, that's a good bridge to a final subject that I wanted. Thanks for your call, Mr. Siegel. A final subject that I wanted to bring up with Kate Pickett, the author, co-author of The Spirit Level, which is Vermont versus New Hampshire. Both high levels of equality. One has a big government, one has a small government approach. Kate Pickett, could you tell us what you found?
Yes, it doesn't seem to matter how you get your greater level of equality. It just seems to matter that you get there. We find a very interesting contrast between Sweden and Japan, for instance. Japan has a very small difference in incomes to start with, whereas Sweden has quite large differences, but then redistributes a lot through taxes and benefits. And when we look at U.S. states, we find that New Hampshire is rather more like Japan and Vermont is rather more like Sweden. But it doesn't seem to matter. You can get the benefits of greater equality either by redistributing through taxes and benefits or by having smaller income differences to start with. But I want to make one really important point, and that is that there's an idea that inequality is beneficial for societies. It creates aspiration, that if we take from the rich to give to the poor, we stifle that kind of creativity and aspiration and innovation. And although it's not, unfortunately, in our U.S. Edition of our book published in December, it is in our paperback UK edition published this week, we have found that more equal societies are actually more creative and more innovative. So it's a win-win situation for more equal societies, actually. They can be economically very productive, they are creative, they are innovative, they waste much less of their potential human productivity. It's not just a question of asking the rich to do something to benefit the poor. Everybody benefits from greater equality.
If you have a society where there are rich and poor, where there are higher and lower levels of income, is there another way to achieve more equal levels of income other than redistributing the income through taxes? Can Sweden become Japan through some other way than taxes, or can Vermont become New Hampshire?
I would point to the U.S. and its history, actually. And as Robert Wright points out in the preface to our book, in the past, the U.S. was a much, much more equal society, and you had a much smaller difference between rich and poor, and that was because income differences were smaller to start with. It wasn't because of huge taxes or benefits. It was to do with economic democracy in the workplace and not allowing top incomes and huge bonuses to run away from the rest of us. So you can do it different ways, and you've done it in the past as a society and benefited from that greater equality. And I actually think it is at the heart of the American dream, actually, to be a more egalitarian society where opportunities are more equal for all. And you've lost your way a little bit. I don't think it's anti-American to suggest that you could do things to turn the corner and go back to your roots.
Kate Pickett is the author of The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger. She's also a professor of epidemiology at the University of York in the UK. Kate, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ed Paquin, we have about 30 seconds left. Final comments?
Well, only to say that I think actually that Act 60 didn't have the effects that your caller described. He's got a different view than I would say I have seen. But I really do think that Dr. Pickett's work jives with what I would say is a sense of common sense, that if we can all do better, live together in one Vermont that works for all of us, we're going to do better than if we concentrate only on public policy that works for a particular group.
Ed Paquin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Ed Paquin is the Executive Director of Disability Rights Vermont, formerly Vermont Protection and Advocacy, and that organization is part of the One Vermont Initiative. Well, we've got a $150 million gap in the state budget. Do we fill it by raising taxes on the wealthy, by cutting services to the vulnerable, or some combination? As we answer that, it's important to keep in mind what economic equality does for everyone's quality of life. I recommend this book, The Spirit Level, to anyone in the legislature or anyone working with municipal budgets. Thanks for the calls from Scott from Northfield and Mr. Siegel on I-89. I'm Carl Ettenayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. Don't forget to check out our website, equaltimeradio.com, for podcasts of the shows that Travin and I host and Ari Levine produce the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Is there a superhero for the transition movement's response to peak oil? The transition movement is about moving from oil dependence to community resilience. It's about finding local goods and services that substitute for oil and the high energy economy, and about finding ways to pursue happiness through meaningful work, friendships, and homegrown games and music. Small-scale farmer and writer Elliot Coleman started me thinking about a transition superhero this weekend when he spoke in Vermont. Coleman suggested the French comic strip character Asterisk as a superhero of small farmers. Asterisk lived in 50 BC when Rome had conquered almost all of what's now known as France. Asterisk is a Gaul, one of the last holdouts. The people of his village cannot be defeated because of strength they get from a village druid's herbal potion. For Coleman, modern-day Rome is corporate farming's bigger-is-better mentality. Asterisk is small and tough and confident in his abilities, like the small-scale farmer who has mastered the art and business of farming. Part of the mastery is finding almost all the inputs to the farm on the farm itself or in its immediate surroundings. Coleman, for example, enriches the soil of his farm near the coast of Maine with seaweed washed ashore during fall storms, plus such things as a lobster and crab shells discarded as part of his neighbor's fishing business. The local inputs, plus composting, planting, and tilling in green manure crops and other practices, are what Coleman does instead of paying agricultural corporations for chemical fertilizers. The compost is his village druid's potion, says Coleman, that will allow him to triumph. For him, triumphing over the bigger is better mentality means not only growing his own food, but also running a profitable business with most of its income staying local. Of course, Rob Hopkins beat me to my wonderings about a transition superhero. Hopkins, the author of The Transition Handbook, writes of Captain Future, a space cowboy, from the 1950s. Hopkins first wrote about Captain Future on his blog and invited readers to contribute ideas about an anti-cowboy for the transition movement. In a typical response, a reader described a ninja peasant who walks by a weed patch in desperate need of hoeing, whips off her mask, and reveals a kindly down-to-earth countenance. And then she hoes away the pesky weeds and then goes back to hunting samurai, after a pause for a cup of tea. One thing about superheroes is that they not only possess superpowers, but they can often use them to do things that I'm just skeptical of, even when I grant them those superpowers. For example, Superman walks into a cooler with refrigerant spouting out of a pipe. He just hits the pipe hard with his hand, and the gas stops flowing immediately. Put me in the same cooler and give me a way to hit the pipe as hard as Superman does, say a really big hammer, and when I hit the pipe, I'd probably knock it clear off and make the gas spew out all the faster. What's really called for in a situation like that is someone who knows where the shutoff valve is. Next, you need a plumber who can repair the broken pipe. In the transition to a more local economy, we need people with knowledge. People who know where and when the nutrient-rich seaweed washes ashore. How to compost it, or when to apply it directly to the soil. We need people who can tell a weed from a crop plant and raise chickens. They can have quite ordinary powers, as long as they know these things and a lot more. On the other hand, I realize that in peaceful Vermont, it's easy to imagine a transition superhero who looks a lot like a farmer on steroids. Our soldiers only fight in other countries. If I had grown up on the front lines of the oil wars, say in Iraq or the Nigerian Delta, I'd be facing people with guns who want to take my country's resources. I might start looking for a more bulletproof superhero. How about Mohandas Gandhi? He was, unfortunately, not bulletproof, but he accomplished quite a lot before he was shot. He cleaned toilets, he spun yarn, and he led people on a march to make salt for themselves. These are all transition-like activities of a leader. At the same time, he defeated the world's dominant empire and forced it to leave his country. Gandhi's loincloth even bears a passing resemblance to superhero tights, although he didn't exactly have bulging muscles. Who is your superhero? Asterisk? Or Gandhi? Or Bucky Bacaw, the backyard chickener? I'm Carl Etnayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.